The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. So can you hear okay? Great. So there are a variety of ways of encapsulating the Buddha's teachings in a short pithy way. And a wonderful way that I'm fond of is the teaching that one should benefit oneself, benefit others, and benefit both self and others. And having that orientation towards one life, the Buddha is a definition in Buddhism for what is a wise person. A wise person, someone's concerned with their own benefit, with the benefit of others, and the benefit of both. And the idea of the benefit for both is interesting because I think it means for us as, I interpret it to be for us as a group, as a society, as a unit. So a unit of two people, it's us as a unit, what's best for us, for society as a whole, for a country as a whole, what's best. And it's presented this way, in a way where it's not one or the other. It's not like what's best for me, and forget about those people out there, and what's best for everyone else, and I should say sacrifice myself, but the idea that we can look for the greater good for all of us together, and what is that, and finding our way for that, is one of the ways that the kind of the pithy ways of talking about Buddhism, and all of Buddhism can be said to come out of that intention, that approach, to trying to understand how we can benefit ourselves, others, and our society around us. So with that as introduction, I wanted to read you an email that came in that Mark sent me, or forwarded to me, that came in through Audio Dharma. I have been listening to Reverend Fransdals as well as everyone else's recordings for about 2 years. Words cannot express my gratitude for your compassionate teachings. Your talks on the five reflections have really touched my heart. I have noticed that Reverend Fransdal usually has a talk following a tragic event, like that in Paris. His talks about compassion and not escalating the violence are beautiful. I live in the Chicagoland area. As you may know, we have a horrific problem with shooting violence in Chicago. Just recently, a 9-year-old boy was killed in Chicago, and the police department categorized it as an assassination. Please take a look at this link. It is a map of homicides in Chicago. Chicago has over 400 homicides, had over 400 homicides in 2014. I'm sure other large cities bear similar sad statistics. I was shocked when I saw the webpage with this map of all the places. I went on the webpage and looked at the map of Chicago and where the homicides occur. And there's a cluster around certain neighborhoods, and I went in close. You can get close into the map to the streets and the blocks, and it seems some areas, every block had a homicide in 2014. The impression I got. Like a tsunami, only the major shooting events get the headlines. Yet, like small waves, nearly every day a person is killed in Chicago. How sad. May I humbly request Reverend Fransdal speak on the subject of daily shootings. So it's in that context that I offered you the teaching at the beginning. What is wise person approaches, what's beneficial for oneself, what's beneficial for others, and what's beneficial for both self and others. That we would, in the Buddhist approach, we would always keep that in the forefront of our attention. That would be the approach. And what it means is that we'd be very hesitant to get into a very strong us versus them scenario. And a polarizing situation where people get isolated. We isolate ourselves, we isolate other people in these kinds of approach. But rather to step forward into the conflict, and metaphorically at least, and see, here we are. How do we find ourselves? How do we find what's best for everyone involved here in this situation? There's a kind of a literature in Buddhism called Jataka tales. They're kind of like Aesop's fables. And I take them as kind of being pure fiction that have a certain fable in it. So, so kind of mythic language maybe. And this particular one has to do with a goat that is being sacrificed at a sacrificial ceremony. Because in India they have these sacrificial ceremonies where they sacrificially sacrifice goats. And you might think that that's kind of cruel, but then they eat the goat. And that's also cruel maybe. But if you're going to eat meat anyway, it's kind of nice at least to do it respectfully, reverentially, and sacrifice and all that. It's kind of, I imagine it's kind of nice. In Nepal, where they have both Buddhist and Hindu people, they have this annual day, celebration, something, sacred day, holiday, where they slaughter sheep and goats as part of their rituals. And that's for the Hindus. And the Buddhists, they feel like they need to participate in this sacrificial day. So they're also quite gruesome in how they do their sacrifice, the Buddhists are. Because they're supposed to do it, they do it on the doorsteps of their homes. They get their really big machete kind of thing and they just really whack the hell out of watermelons. That's what I've read. I've been in Nepal, I haven't seen it. But so anyway, so this goat is going to be sacrificed. And when he's being led up to the place where he's going to be killed, the goat first starts laughing and then starts crying. And so the person who's going to sacrifice him says, what's going on? Why are you first laughing and now crying? So the goat explains himself. And he says, well, for 500 years, I've been reborn as a goat. And I realized this is my last lifetime as a goat. And now I'm going to be reborn as a human, finally. So that's why I'm laughing, so happy about this. And I'm crying because I also remembered the reason I was reborn 500 times as a goat is that 500 lifetimes ago, when I was a human, last time I was a human, I sacrificed a goat. and I'm crying for you. So, you know, I take this as a kind of a mythic or fable-like language. The lesson of this kind of thing is that it comes back to you. That what you do will come back to you. You can't really avoid. And as a society, we have to be very careful that how we react and respond to our world around us or what happens in our society as a whole doesn't also come back and bite us and cause more problems than we want. So in Buddhism, so there's a quote from the Buddha. When one takes life, one breeds dread and hatred in the world. When one breeds dread and hatred in this world, one experiences pain and grief. So this idea comes back in some way or other. So if you spread fear and hatred, it'll come back and bite you. You yourself experience pain and grief. When one abstains from taking life, one doesn't breed hatred and dread in the world, and dread and hatred will cease. So if you're able to withhold from spreading dread and hatred, then the dread and hatred will come to an end. Famous, very famous Buddha quote is the one that says, hatred will never end by hatred, but by non-hatred only, alone, will hatred end. By love alone will hatred end. And then to emphasize how important this idea is, the Buddha said, this is the ancient law, the eternal law. Hate does not end with hate. So not killing is the first ethical precept in Buddhism. And the way that this precept is worded more formally is abandoning the taking of life, one lives without weapons, mindful, compassionate, concerned for the welfare of all people. So here it's not just a matter of not killing, but also living without any weapons. And that was the message I received from kind of growing up in Buddhism, you know, when I came to it when I was 19 or 20, was that I was inspired by the very strong message of nonviolence and not using weapons and having weapons. And I thought that's what Buddhism was teaching. And then I was a bit shocked to discover that some of the senior Zen teachers that I had, one of them had a gun, and then one of the priests that was kind of a peer of mine when I was a priest, Zen priest, also had a gun. And I was kind of like, what? How could this be? It kind of didn't compute. It just didn't seem like that was really odd to me. Because for me, the idea of being a monk or a priest is you're a public person representing the forces of love, compassion, and nonviolence for this world. And that's kind of, you know, what you stand for and willing to stake your life on. So here the Buddha said not killing means also to abide without having weapons. And for lay people, the right livelihood in Buddhism is not to engage in the trade of weapons. So a few other things are just wrong livelihood as well. But the being involved in the trade of weapons and poison that can kill people is considered to be a wrong livelihood. And for a Buddhist monastic, even killing an ant is considered wrong. They have to be that careful, not to intentionally kill an ant. And even more than that, a Buddhist monastic is not allowed to intentionally cause anxiety in other people. Isn't that nice? It's kind of inspiring. No intentional distress, causing distress for other people. And if you're a monastic, if you do that intentionally, you have to go confess it. So next time that you find yourself, you know, intentionally kind of causing some distress for some people, you might go try confessing it to someone and see what happens. Maybe not the person you did it to, but the Buddha said, victory gives birth to hate. The defeated sleep tormented, giving up both victory and defeat, the peaceful sleep delighted. The peaceful sleep delighted. So this kind of, you know, what does that mean, giving up both victory and defeat? Is there a third option? Or is it only winning or losing is the only option? And if that's the way we think, then we begin with opposition. We begin with polarization. And it makes it hard to be the kind of wise person that considers what's beneficial for myself, what's beneficial for others, what's beneficial for both. All tremble at violence, all fear death. Having likened others to oneself, don't kill or cause to kill. Having likened others to oneself. So kind of the call for empathy of trying to putting yourself in other people's shoes and you in their shoes, you know, kind of exchanging self and other is an ancient Buddhist practice. And kind of feeling and knowing this kind of commonality and knowing each other's lives in a deep way. Based on that, how could you kill or cause to kill? The Buddha said, an angry person doesn't realize that danger is born from within. An angry person doesn't know what brings personal benefits. A person conquered by anger is in a mass of darkness. So there might be lots of rationale people have for getting angry and justifying being angry. And here, anger in this context here should be understood as being anger that's infused with hostility. And so when we're angry in this way, we harm ourselves. And this is one of the great teachings of Buddhism. And other places as well said this. Remember many years ago I came across this, maybe some of you did too, of there was some journalists, I think, who were kept hostage in Lebanon in the 1980s, I think, for some 7 years. And one of them was finally released, and after some time was asked, do you have resentment towards your captors? And he said, no, because then I'd be harming myself. So the idea that there might be cause to resent other people, but who gets harmed in that? One person here at IMC, remember, told me that she had this anger and resentment towards her ex-husband for a long time. And then one day, she realized that he was far away and unconcerned with her whatsoever, and he was not suffering at all because of her resentment. The only person who was suffering was her. And when she saw the difference between him getting off scot-free without, and her simmering in her resentment, then she let go of it. Maybe because sometimes we're slightly hoping that the resentment's going to, stick it to them, And when you realize it doesn't, and you realize who's being stuck to, then maybe willing to kind of ease up, let go. A lot of teachings in Buddha, in the early teachings of the Buddha about anger. When anger spreads, the angry person has no shame, no fear of evil. That's a kind of interesting statement. Killing others, one does violence to oneself. The angry person doesn't realize that he is ruined. So it's true with this email I got from Chicago that at times of some large crisis, large act of violence in our society, that I give talks on this, and I feel like I can't not do it. And usually when I do it, I feel like I don't know what I'm going to say. I mean, what could we say, and what could I say that's not platitudes, and what can I say that is useful and helpful? And after the shootings in San Bernardino, and getting this email here, and the email is right. It's not just Chicago where there's 400 homicides. Places like Baltimore and the other cities in this country. So here's an interesting statistic. People have been shot in Chicago in 2014. It's a lot of people. Since 9/11, so about 14 or so years, 45 people in the United States have been killed by what's been labeled terrorism. 400 in 1 year in Baltimore alone, and 45 in the whole country. And so what happens is that the terrorist attacks, loom big in people's consciousness, in people's minds. And people react quite strongly. And one of the strong reactions that happened, I guess yesterday or something, was the president of the largest Christian university and private university in the country, Liberty University, a man named Jerry Falwell Jr., spoke in an assembly of his students and said that encouraged his students to get a license to have a concealed weapon and to bring guns with him to school. And then he patted his back pocket, indicating he was carrying one revolver himself. And that the university was going to offer free training to its students. And he said, if we carry our guns, then we will be able to take out the Muslims before they see us, before they come. And later he said, well, I didn't mean Muslims, I meant Muslim terrorists. So this is a kind of reactive response. And then whenever there are these reactions, these big events in their country, like this thing in San Bernardino, and then President Obama speaks up and says we have to have gun control, every time Obama says there should be gun control, There are people who flock to gun stores to stock up before the laws prevent them from getting it. And the tremendous number of guns in America, and tremendous, you know, people buying it up, and not just buying guns, but buying atomic, you know, these automatic weapons, that AK machine guns kind of thing, and then body armor. And I wonder what Jerry Falwell will do with his pistol when someone shows up with body armor and an assault rifle. It seems like a certain disparity there. Soon we'll have assault rifles in our classrooms to protect us. Isn't that nice? I'll feel really safe. So there's reactivity that happens. And so it almost doesn't work to champion gun control if you're for that, because there's a tremendous reactionary force against it in our society. So right now there are more guns in private hands in America than there are people. Something like 310 million registered guns. And that 310 million guns, it's phenomenal. Rifles, pistols, things like that. And are we a safer country because of that? You know, are we safer against terrorism? Because of that, is terrorism such a big threat? Those 45 people killed in 15 years versus 400 people in Baltimore and Chicago. So I don't know, you know, what's supposed to happen. I mean, we shouldn't be passive and do nothing. And if we are too active and too opinionated by it and make it the them out there, it reinforces the reactionary forces in our society, the polarizing forces in our society. And one of the things that's been pointed out is radicalization. People get radicalized or become extremist in whatever direction they're going to, tends to become stronger when people get polarized. And as people get polarized and get isolated, it also supports radicalization, extremism. And so if anybody's reaction is, you know, strong, it tends to create a counterforce. And so that counterforce creates a second counterforce. And sometimes it goes back and forth and gets stronger. And one of the ways that this is used apparently intentionally among some people called terrorists is called, some places called jiu-jitsu politics. And that is, if you can do a terrorist attack and get the government to overreact and to get them to kind of come down strong on the populace more widely, then the moderates will get radicalized and join the terrorists. And so the whole point of the terrorist attack is not to bring down the government, but to get the government to help radicalize more people. So it's kind of, you know, so if we respond strongly and harshly, it tends to make the whole thing worse, which is what happened a little bit in the American prison system, where people who were criminals, maybe, ended up in our prison system and were radicalized even more and then came back on the streets and became a vicious cycle. So what's the alternative? And what kind of alternative is there? What I like to think about is that I don't really know how to respond too well to what is, but I think that it's very important to think about the future. What kind of future do we want to live in? And that, what are the conditions and situations we're putting in place now that's going to mature or flower into something in 15 and 20 years? Are we creating the conditions for more radicalization to happen in 15, 20 years? Or are we putting in the conditions that allow for the opposite, more harmony, more love? And I think this is where this Buddhist teachings of a wise person considers what's beneficial for self and for others and for everyone is really important for the future. That if we want to have a good future, that understanding that what's good for me is good for others. That if we can come from love, from generosity, from wisdom, from kindness, that's good for oneself. It's healing for oneself to do that. And it's good for others, and it creates the seeds or creates the conditions that help support concord, help support people coming together in supportive ways. If we now succumb to fear, if we succumb to hatred and anger to what we hear and see in the news, what are we setting in motion then for the future? Becoming afraid and becoming angry is a natural enough response, but is that what we want to act from? Is that how we want to speak from? And so to have the ability to look at oneself and be still, to recognize what's going on inside of ourselves, and to recognize what choices we have of what we act on and what we don't act on, what we let go of and what we do. A soldier general once came to the Buddha and said, "I hear that you teach inaction, doing nothing. You know, you're sitting there meditating under a tree all day and letting the world go by and being nonviolent." And I'm not, you know, general, so I should ask that. It's kind of an interesting one. Maybe someone who's responsible for protecting his country. And the Buddha said, "In one way, it is true, I teach inaction. And in another way, I teach action. The way that I teach inaction is I teach inaction on motivations based on lust, hostility, and delusion. And I teach action on motivations based on love, kindness, generosity, and wisdom." So we have that choice within us. What do we want to support? What do we want to value? What do we want to nourish our own hearts with? What do we want to nourish our society with? And I put my eggs in the basket of trying to create the seeds, trying to create the conditions that are supportive and helpful for the world around us, that somehow tries to overcome polarization, tries to overcome extremism, tries to overcome the forces of hate and fear. And I think it always begins with ourselves. I think one of the very sad things is when people are waiting for someone else to do something. They're supposed to do it, whatever it is. But if we want to create a society where love and generosity and friendship, kindness, is the hallmark of the society, I think it needs to start with us, with you, with me. Because, you know, the whole world, in Buddhism, the whole world begins with you. For all of Buddha's teachings about not-self, you are so important in Buddhism. Because the whole world's not going to start anywhere else. That kind of emphasis, the world begins with you. And what kind of world will you create? What kind of world will you create into the future? What kind of conditions will you make? So to sit and meditate, to have mindfulness, and really kind of look deeply into your own heart and mind, to understand how these forces operate inside of you, to understand how you get caught in these forces and blinded by them sometimes, and to learn how to not give in to the forces of hate and delusion and greed, and how, let them settle, let them kind of fall away, and try to nourish and support the opposite so that we can all benefit. Because if it benefits us, it benefits others. If it benefits others, it benefits ourselves. That's what we're looking for. A wise person benefits self, a wise person benefits others, and a wise person benefits both self and others. And in doing that, I hope we can have confidence in that. And if we have confidence in that, then we won't despair at the violence we see around us. People tend to despair and shut down the most when they feel they have no confidence. They have no confidence they can make a difference. When they feel kind of like they're helpless victims of this whole thing, just reading about this news day after day or something, or hearing the gunshots in the neighborhood and feel like it's hopeless. But we can always do something. Maybe not for the specific things that we read about or see, but we can always do something to have confidence in that we can respond and make a difference as the world gets born out of us. Then I think there's not any reason for despair. there's only reason for lots of you know, encouragement and inspiration. Yes, we can make a difference. So I thank the person in Chicago who sent this email. I was kind of very touched by this. Some weeks ago I gave a talk on called Grieving in Paris, and I said in that talk that I mentioned that I guess the shootings in Paris happened on a Friday, and on Saturday someone flew from Paris to California to be on the retreat that started on Sunday. And so I mentioned that Monday, I mentioned that, you know, Paris is here in California so quickly, right? So I got an email a few weeks after giving that talk, Grieving in Paris, from a Citigroup in Paris that said, we listened to your talk, and we want to tell you that California is in Paris. So the world is here with us, and may we take care of this world, and may we produce out of you a new world. The world will start with you. Oh, thank you.